So our passage that we're considering this morning is Acts chapter 21, verses 17 to 39. So in one classic sketch, Laurel and Hardy are engaged in a DIY project. Hardy hands Laurel the hammer and holds the nail in place before uttering those fateful words, "When I nod my head, you hit it." You know what happens next. Hardy nods and Laurel dutifully brings the hammer crashing down, not on the nail, but on his friend's head. Well, in the passage this morning, the Apostle Paul is not engaged in a DIY project, but like Oliver Hardy, he is misunderstood in this passage, and in fact with just as painful consequences. In fact, he's not just misunderstood in one way, he's misunderstood in three ways. In this passage, Paul being misunderstood is very much the recurring theme here. And that being so then, I would like us just for a few minutes this morning to explore this. So notice with me first of all then, he's misunderstood by Christians. That's the first thing. He's misunderstood by Christians. And this is verses 17 to 25. So Paul, you remember from last week, if you were here, has arrived now in Jerusalem. There he is lodging with Mnason, that early disciple from Cyprus. We're told that in verse 16. And remember, we saw last week that on his way to Jerusalem, he stops over at Tyre, and he stops over at Caesarea. And we said that in both those places, as he gathers with the believers there, there's tension in the air. But it's kind of good tension, if you like. It's like a husband and wife, and they're having a cup of tea together, and there's one biscuit left on the plate, and they have an argument over it. But he's saying, "No, you have it." And she's saying, "No, no, you have it, dear." And so it goes on. And there's a point of tension there, but it's kind of a good tension. You don't need to get a marriage counsellor in to sort out that particular issue. And here then in Tyre and in Caesarea, in the first half of this chapter, the believers are arguing with Paul, but it's kind of good tension because they're arguing with him about what he does next, and the reason for that is because they're fond of him and they don't want him to suffer. And they don't want him to go headlong into a situation of persecution and even possible death. So there's been this tension in the air in Tyre and Caesarea, and now Paul's in Jerusalem. And again, as he gathers with Christians in Jerusalem, there's tension in the air. But this time it's not good tension. The problem that the Jerusalem believers have with Paul doesn't arise out of protectiveness and concern for him. "Paul, you're courting danger if you go down that route." No, the problem that the Jerusalem believers have with Paul arises out of suspicion and annoyance. "Paul, you are betraying your Jewish roots." That's their problem with Paul. That's the attitude that apparently many believers in Jerusalem are harboring toward him. We don't encounter it directly in the passage, but we have it reported, don't we, by James and the elders in this meeting that they have with Paul. They report to him this attitude that's abroad amongst the Jerusalem believers. There's suspicion there, there's annoyance there, James and the elders say. Because they feel, "Paul, that you're betraying your Jewish roots." So why then do they harbour that attitude toward him? Why do they think that Paul is betraying his Jewish roots? Well, the answer to that comes in verse 21, doesn't it? Where James and the elders tell Paul, they, that's the Jewish believers here in Jerusalem, "they have been told about you that you teach all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children or walk according to our customs." So they've been told then, these Jewish believers in Jerusalem, they've been told that this is Paul's message. As he goes around Gentile cities, and in each city he encounters Jewish believers, this is Paul's message to them: you mustn't practice circumcision anymore. And you mustn't, in fact, practice any of the customs of the law of Moses anymore. You must completely turn your backs on all that stuff. They've been told that that's Paul's message to Jewish believers all over the place. Was that Paul's message to Jewish believers? Well, no, it wasn't. We can safely say that for at least three reasons. Reason number one, you think back to Paul's own practice back in chapter 18 and verse 18. So in chapter 18, he's been in Corinth and he's about to leave Corinth. And we read this in chapter 18, verse 18. Paul stayed many days longer, then took leave of the brothers and set sail for Syria, and with him Priscilla and Aquila. At Cenchreae, he had cut his hair, for he was under a vow. What's that about? Well, this was clearly a very Jewish thing that Paul was doing here. Probably the vow, as I explained when we were in that passage a few weeks ago, it's probably connected to the vision that he's had there in Corinth. I have many people in this city. And probably then the vow is either thankful, it's either an expression of thankfulness to the Lord for that reassuring vision, or it's an expression of faith in the message of the vision. But one way or the other, it's probably connected with the vision. But the point is this, that it's a very Jewish thing that Paul is doing there in chapter 18, verse 8. So he himself hasn't kind of turned his back on all that stuff. Then again, you have reason number two, Paul's willingness to comply with James and the elders' suggestion here. So he does get on with what they recommend he does. He takes this purification rites and he sponsors some Jewish believers in Jerusalem who are taking a Nazarite vow. And he doesn't then balk at that. He doesn't say, oh no, I can possibly do that because I'm a believer and we've turned our back completely on the law of Moses. No, he complies with the suggestion. And then reason number three, you think of Romans 14. And in Romans 14, then Paul expresses there that he is happy to tolerate Jewish believers in that Roman church who practice law of Moses customs. They only eat vegetables and they keep certain holy days of the year. And the remarkable thing there is that he's willing to tolerate these Jewish believers in Rome who are doing that not merely on the basis that they want to retain their cultural identity as Jews, but they're doing it on conscientious grounds. They believe they should only eat vegetables and they should keep holy days of the year. And Paul's still okay with that. He says they're weak, those believers. Their consciences need to be better informed, but he doesn't say excommunicate them. No, he tolerates those Jewish believers who on conscientious grounds are still practicing law of Moses customs. So clearly then, it's not the case that Paul is going around from place to place telling Jewish believers, stop practicing circumcision, stop keeping anything that's in the law of Moses. That's not true. So why then have these believers in Jerusalem been told that that is Paul's message and that is what Paul is going around saying? Well, to answer that, we first need to look at verse 25. And in verse 25, then, James and the elders kind of are coming to the end of their speech to Paul. And they say, as for the Gentiles who have believed, we have sent a letter with our judgment that they should abstain from what has been sacrificed to idols and from blood and from what has been strangled and from sexual immorality. When I was in Cambridge before coming here, I was an assistant minister, and Ian Hamilton was the minister there, and he was a wonderfully gracious and encouraging and supportive mentor, but he didn't always look like it when you were preaching. He kind of sit there, and I guess it was just his way of concentrating and processing what was being said, but with his kind of big eyebrows, he would look quite austere and disapproving. I don't know what it was like preaching to Paul, but I suspect that as James and the elders are not quite preaching to him, but are going through all this with him in this meeting here, I suspect they're conscious at points of Paul fidgeting quite a bit, of Paul perhaps staring at them with rather piercing eyes. They probably sense that at certain points the thought is at least crossing Paul's mind. Have James and the elders weakened their grip on the gospel? Have they become too fixated on circumcision and the law of Moses? Has a gulf developed between Paul's justification by grace through faith Christianity and James's Christianity, which perhaps is just a little bit kind of confused with elements of circumcision, the law of Moses still in there? I suspect James and the elders are conscious that those thoughts are going through Paul's head. And that's why then they finish their speech with that verse, verse 25, about how the Gentiles don't need to be circumcised. Because that really is the main force, actually, of verse 25. Remember, those are the stipulations that the church agreed on in that Jerusalem council back in chapter 15. And really, the main point there is that Gentile believers don't have to be circumcised. They don't have to come under the law of Moses. Yes, they must abstain from idolatrous practices, from going into the idol temples. And that, I think, is what all those stipulations are about. You remember, I explained that in connection with chapter 15. Yes, they must turn their backs on their idol worship, but they don't need to be circumcised. They don't need to come under the law of Moses. And you see, James and the elders know that that will reassure Paul, because they know that that's Paul's big thing. That's what Paul's really passionate about. That's Paul's great message as he goes around. Gentiles don't need to be circumcised, because justification is by grace through faith in Jesus Christ. And now then, having established that, we're in a position to answer the question I raised a moment ago. Why have believers in Jerusalem been told that Paul is telling Jewish believers, to stop being circumcised? Well, clearly, there's been a misunderstanding. And Paul's message then, Gentiles, you don't need to be circumcised, that has been misunderstood as, Jews, you must not be circumcised. Now, that is a complete misunderstanding of Paul. For Paul, his anti-circumcision stance toward Gentiles when preaching the gospel, that didn't mean that he was anti-Jews being circumcised. You see, circumcision had no cultural attractiveness for Gentiles. And the only motive then that a Gentile would have in getting circumcised was as a salvation-earning work, because that Gentile thinks that that will somehow make him right with God. And that's why Paul was so against Gentiles being circumcised, because it was connected with salvation. For Jews, on the other hand, of course, there was a great cultural attractiveness about circumcision. It was the normal thing for Jews, had been for centuries, and there were plenty of reasons why they would want to be circumcised, quite apart from, or quite outside of, wanting to gain some acceptance with God. And so Paul wasn't bothered about Jews being circumcised and maintaining that aspect of their cultural background. But you see, this distinction hadn't been appreciated by some, obviously. And Paul's message then, Gentiles, you don't need to be circumcised. That had been misunderstood by some as Jews, you must not be circumcised. And that then had been spread around. And it had reached these believers in Jerusalem. And they had been offended by it. And sadly, that's all too common, isn't it? For Christians to be misunderstood by other Christians, and for that misunderstanding to be scurrilously and unhelpfully and damagingly spread around. So there's a Christian who's sympathetic toward an old earth view of creation, and he gets misunderstood, and it's spread around. So-and-so believes in Darwinian evolution. There's a Christian who has his infant baptized. It gets misunderstood. It's spread around. So-and-so believes that a splash of water makes their child a Christian. There's a Christian who chooses not to have a TV in the home. It gets misunderstood. Or so-and-so believes that having a TV is sinful. There's a Christian who is involved alongside people of other faiths in a campaign about some moral issue, abortion, euthanasia, something like that. And it gets misunderstood and spread around, oh, so-and-so believes that you're saved, whatever religion you follow. And we all need to be so careful, don't we, that we're never part of that process, that we're never spreaders of misunderstandings about other Christians' views on things. That we never make a negative comment about what another Christian believes unless we have heard or read from the person, him or herself, and know for certain what that person really does believe. If we're making negative comments about what other Christians believe on any other basis, then it's scurrilous, it's gossip, it's loose talk of the kind that should never occur in the Church of Jesus Christ. By the way, don't we have a wonderful example of precise Christian speech in our passage, in verse 19, and it's a different context. This is Paul reporting to James and the elders what's been going on during his mission trip, and it says there, after greeting them, he related one by one the things that God had done among the Gentiles. Precision, one by one. No exaggeration, no kind of generalizations, but one by one. And that's the kind of precise speech which should characterize all of us as Christians. And in that way, then, we won't spread damaging misunderstandings about what our brothers and sisters believe. So that's the first thing this morning. He's misunderstood by Christians. But then notice, secondly, he's misunderstood by enemies. He's misunderstood by enemies. This is verses 26 to 36. So in order to reassure these believers in Jerusalem who have got this wrong idea of his message, in order to reassure them then, Paul does indeed comply, as I've already said, with James and the elders' suggestion. He takes this purification rite. It's probably then because he's been on Gentile soil and he's come back now to Jerusalem, he kind of takes a purification rite on that basis. I doubt he would have done that. Maybe he would have done that anyway. Probably not, though. Probably because it would have been so dangerous, as indeed it proved to be so dangerous, going to the temple. But now, in these circumstances, he feels that this is the best thing to do, as James and the elders have suggested. And not only, of course, to take this purification rite for himself, but to pay for the sacrifices of four Nazarites. And just then to really go the extra mile to impress upon Jewish believers in Jerusalem that I'm not anti-Jewishness, I'm not anti-Law of Moses customs. And this then means him going to the temple. It means, in fact, him going to the temple twice. He has to go, first of all, to give notice when the days of his purification will be fulfilled, verse 26. And then 7 days later, he has to return to the temple. And it's on that second occasion, then, that he's seen by enemies, by Jews who now are not believers in Christ, are not part of the church, Jews who hate Paul. In fact, we're told, aren't we, in verse 27, they're Jews from Asia, possibly like some of the Jews we encounter back in chapter 6. They are originally from Asia, but now living in Jerusalem. That's possible. Or it's even possible that, no, these Jews live in Asia, and they followed Paul all the way to Jerusalem precisely in order to make trouble for him. Certainly, that would make sense when we come to verse 29 and they recognize Trophimus as a Gentile, as an Ephesian. Now, possibly he just looked like one. Or possibly these are Jews from Ephesus who have followed Paul to make trouble for him, and they know Trophimus. And that's how they recognize him. That's certainly possible. But anyway, here they are, and they see Paul in the temple. And earlier on, perhaps that day or earlier on in the week, they've seen Paul with this Gentile, Trophimus. And so they put two and two together. And they assume that Trophimus has been with Paul into the temple courts where no Gentile was allowed to go. And of course, it's a complete misunderstanding. Paul hasn't taken any Gentile into the temple. Yes, he's with Gentiles during this stay in Jerusalem, but he's not going with Gentiles into the temple. It's a misunderstanding. And of course, this misunderstanding, then, unlike the first one we've considered, it doesn't just attract suspicion and annoyance. This one attracts violence. And by the way, remember, as this violence ensues and as this scene spirals out of control, remember that if those Christians hadn't scurrilously spread about that first misunderstanding, then none of this would ever have happened, because Paul wouldn't have come to a church in Jerusalem that was suspicious of him, and James and the elders wouldn't have suggested that he went to the temple to carry out these rites. And there would never have been this misunderstanding about Trophimus, therefore. And there would never have been this riot and this violence. Isn't it a powerful reminder of what James says about the tongue and how dangerous the tongue is? How great a forest is set ablaze. This is chapter 3 of James' epistle. How great a forest is set ablaze by such a small fire, and the tongue is a fire, a world of unrighteousness. The tongue is set among our members, staining the whole body, setting on fire the entire course of life, and set on fire by hell. It's true, isn't it, that the tongue, in gossip, in slander, in rumour, the tongue can cause massively disproportionate consequences, massively disproportionate damage to the size and the apparent significance of it as a bodily organ. Relationships can be ripped apart because of the tongue. Churches can be ripped apart because of the tongue. Paul here almost loses his life because of the tongue, because people have been spreading a misunderstanding through the churches of Paul's message. And that almost cost Paul his life here in Jerusalem. And so it is then, with all this violence, that the Romans have to come and sort it out. And it's that point that I just want to quickly linger over here then. So there's been this misunderstanding by Paul's enemies. They think that he's taken a Greek into the temple. They then lay hands on him and they're trying to kill him, Luke says. And so the Romans have to come and sort it out. One of our members, who shall remain nameless, said to me the other day that the best part of my sermons are the last few minutes. And I suppose there are different ways of taking that. It could be that the sermon reaches a crescendo, or it could be that the first half an hour is drivel and we better cut out. Perhaps it's the latter. But remember Agabus's little sermon or little prophetic message in Caesarea there earlier on in the chapter. But Agabus was that prophet from Jerusalem. He comes down to Caesarea and he delivers this little message. And certainly his message, it reaches a crescendo in terms of drama. He says, doesn't he, there, remember he takes the belt and he takes Paul's belt, he ties it around himself, and he says there in verse 11, this is how the Jews at Jerusalem will bind the man who owns this belt. And that's pretty dramatic, and you can imagine the reaction that that would be getting from Agabus's audience there in that Caesarean church. But then this, the crescendo, and deliver him into the hands of the Gentiles. And that would have brought gasps to his audience, because that could only mean one thing. Being handed over to the Gentiles in Jerusalem could only mean the Roman authorities, the authorities that a few years earlier had crucified Jesus, the Roman government, so formidable, so notorious in its brutality and its force and its power and its capacity for violence and humiliation. And Agabus is saying that Paul is going to be handed over to them. It would have brought gasps to the room. And perhaps even Paul, although yes, as he says in verse 13, I am ready not only to be in prison, but even to die in Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus. I wonder if even for Paul it played on his mind a little bit in the following days, that reference handed over to the Gentiles. Certainly, it would have haunted Paul's friends and brothers and sisters in Christ who heard it from the lips of Agabus. But you see, here we are now in Jerusalem, and it happens. And Paul does come into the hands of the Gentiles. This Roman tribune and his centurions and soldiers dashing down the street to get their hands on Paul. But actually, there's a huge twist here, isn't there? Because this isn't the terrible thing that Paul must have imagined and that everyone else in that room in Caesarea who heard Agabus' prophecy must have imagined. Actually, this intervention by the Romans saves Paul's life. He's about to be killed by his Jewish enemies. And the tribune comes along and rescues Paul. In fact, even in rescuing him, he has a job to keep the Jews from still attacking Paul. They're still trying to get at Paul as he's being carried, and he has to be taken into the barracks for safety. But this Roman intervention here, it's not the crowning horror that everyone who heard Agabus' prophecy must have thought it was going to be. It's actually a helpful, positive development in that moment in the streets of Jerusalem. And is that not a beautiful example of what we sang earlier in our service this morning? You fearful saints, fresh courage take, the clouds you so much dread are big with mercy and shall break in blessings on your head. That must have been a cloud that they were dreading from the moment Agabus uttered it, handed over to the Gentiles. What a cloud over their heads, waiting for it, waiting for it. And it comes, and it pours blessings on them, because Paul is rescued from those who are about to kill him by being handed over to the Gentiles. And more than that, of course, Paul has said, hasn't he, back in chapter 19, verse 21, remember how he said there to the believers, this is in Ephesus, He said that I must go to Achaia and go to Jerusalem. After I've been there, I must also see Rome. Why does he want to see Rome? Not a sightseeing trip, but let me put it in the context of the previous verse, verse 20, the word of the Lord continued to increase and prevail mightily. That's in Ephesus. Well, Paul is saying now that I need to go to Rome so that the word of the Lord can prevail mightily there as well. Well, you know what? This is how Paul's going to get to Rome. Through the Romans arresting him on the streets of Jerusalem here now in our passage. Because that will set in motion a sequence. Paul will never be out of captivity now in the rest of Acts. That will set in motion a sequence of events that will culminate in Paul arriving in Rome and being able, through house arrest, under those conditions, to spread the gospel there. And so this terrible dark cloud, and yet it actually pours down blessings. I wonder, do we really believe the principle that we sang in that hymn? That is how God works in our lives. That the darkest clouds always have divine blessings within them. I mean, if we could have an Agabus come to us today, and if he could go to each of us and lay out the rest of our lives for us, there would be many things, wouldn't there, in the story of the rest of our lives that would make us gasp this morning. We know there would. Things that would then become clouds haunting us and frightening us about the future. Do we really believe, though, that those darkest clouds that lie ahead, those moments that would make us gasp the most this morning if we knew about them in advance, God has packed those experiences with blessings for us? Otherwise, they wouldn't be there in the plan for our lives. I've quoted to you before John Calvin's very poignant words, the only recorded words that we have from him on the matter of his son who died in infancy. And obviously it was a devastating event. It was the only child that he ever had, and that child died. And Calvin's comment in a letter to a friend was, he talked about how much he'd struggled, how grievous this trial was. But he said, God is himself a father, and he knows best what is good for his children. God is himself a father, and he knows best what is good for his children. And so he was saying that even this, somehow, it's good for me. Even in this dark, dark cloud, my Father is doing something good for me, somehow. Remember Jesus teaching how our Father in heaven, he doesn't give his children stones instead of bread. He doesn't give them serpents instead of fish. But he is a loving Father. He only gives good things. And that applies then in the realm of providence, in the realm of the events that God puts in our lives. He's in control. If something happens, it's from him. And if he's a God who doesn't give stones and serpents, but bread and fish, then that event must be a loaf of bread or a fish, not a stone, not a serpent, because it's from him. Let's really reflect on this principle. The clouds that break in blessings on our head. And let's believe that this is the God who controls our lives. So Paul then, he's misunderstood by Christians, he's misunderstood by enemies. But then thirdly and finally, he's misunderstood by authorities. He's misunderstood by authorities. This is verses 37 to 39. Because Paul then has been arrested by the Romans now, and you'll notice then that there's this short conversation ensues between Paul and the tribune, and Paul speaks to the tribune in Greek, and that triggers this idea in the tribune's mind that Paul is this Egyptian. Greek would have been at this point widely spoken in Egypt. And so the tribune thinks then that Paul is this Egyptian who recently had led this revolt involving 4,000 men. Now we know from other historical sources, not least Josephus, the Jewish historian, we know a little bit about this particular revolt, and it was then an attempt to deliver Jerusalem from the Romans. It was an attempt to liberate Jerusalem and restore Jerusalem's independence. And in fact, apparently this Egyptian, he was convinced that on marching toward Jerusalem, the walls would fall down, as in Jericho. That was this conviction that he had. So this man was an anti-Roman, pro-Jewish nationalist who had led this rebellion. And this tribune then, he thinks Paul is that man. He thinks Paul is a terrorist, effectively. It's ironic, actually, isn't it, when you think of the different misunderstandings that go on in this passage. And here are all these Jews then, both in the church and outside the church, who misunderstand Paul as being so anti-Jewish. And here now is this tribune who misunderstands Paul as being so pro-Jewish that he would even take up arms and fight against the Romans. And so there are all these conflicting misunderstandings swirling around when it comes to Paul. But isn't there a somewhat contemporary feel to this particular misunderstanding? Here, this tribune, seeing Paul, and he's an evangelical preacher, and he labels him a terrorist. Isn't that what we're facing in our own day, increasingly? Evangelical Christianity being lumped together with extremism, which leads to terrorism. There's an email from the Christian Institute yesterday that some of you will have seen, talking about that very thing, and thanking the Lord for a report from a committee led by Harriet Harman that points to this very thing, that the counter-extremism measures that the governments are proposing, that they will catch up within them evangelical Christians who have no intention of committing any violence. But this is what happens. We get lumped together, don't we? And I'm saying we shouldn't be surprised by this, because it was happening to Paul as well. The authorities then just lumped the preacher of the gospel, Paul, together with extremists who were willing to take up arms and fight against the government. It's not something new. Doesn't mean we shouldn't seek to protest against it and write to MPs and so on, but we shouldn't be surprised by it, I'm saying. It's been there from the start. And so here is Paul then. And throughout this passage, I'm saying he's misunderstood. Misunderstood by Christians, misunderstood by enemies, misunderstood by authorities. And you might think then, well, it's a bit of a quirky kind of theme to be considering this morning, kind of Paul being misunderstood. Actually, I don't think it is a quirky theme at all. Because when you go back to Paul's master, Jesus, don't we see this theme as a fairly pronounced one in his life? Jesus was misunderstood. He was misunderstood by Christians. In fact, John's gospel ends strikingly, doesn't it, on this very note of Jesus being misunderstood by his own disciples. Remember how Jesus gives that prediction to Peter as to how he was going to die. And then Peter says, what about him? What about John? And Jesus says, well, what if I want him to remain until I come, what is that to you? And John says that the rumor circulated amongst Christians that Jesus would come back before John died. But Jesus hadn't said that. He said, if I will that John remain alive until I come, what is that to you? But that was misunderstood and then spread around. Oh, Jesus is saying he's going to come back within one generation. He's going to come back before John dies. Misunderstood by Christians. He was misunderstood by his enemies. You think of that comment that Jesus made, that they accuse me of being a glutton and a drunkard because I go to tax collectors and sinners' houses and I eat and drink with them. They accuse me of being a glutton and a drunkard. How far from the truth was that? Jesus was anything but a glutton and a drunkard, but misunderstood by his enemies. And then, of course, Jesus was misunderstood by the authorities. You think of Pilate. And what's the final thing that changes Pilate's mind, or at least that decides Pilate's mind? Well, it's the Jews shouting out, well, you're no friend of Caesar's if you let this man live. And you see, they're saying, look, here's this man, and he's a rival king to Caesar. And Pilate seemingly believes that. That Jesus is a rival king to Caesar, that he's the same kind of king, operating on the same kind of political, territorial basis. Which of course isn't the case at all. Jesus' kingdom is an entirely different kind of kingdom. But Pilate misunderstands. Jesus was misunderstood by Christians, by enemies, by authorities. And it is therefore an inevitable part of discipleship. Whether you're Paul or whether you're us today, that we shall be misunderstood. If Jesus was, then we shall be. And of course, there's nothing worse than being misunderstood, is there? Just at a basic level, when you're trying to just explain some directions to someone and they just can't get their head around the directions you're giving, that's frustrating. But it is horrible being misunderstood. It's unpleasant. And especially, of course, as Christians in our society, being misunderstood to be homophobic, to be bigots, when we are those who love others and just want them to be saved through this gospel of grace and saved from their sinful lifestyles. It's frustrating, it's unpleasant being misunderstood. But doesn't it dignify being misunderstood, the fact that Jesus was so misunderstood himself? Yes, when we're misunderstood, it's unpleasant. But it's following the footsteps of our Master. It's the path that he walked. It's a dignified path to walk because it's his path. And in the depths then of being misunderstood as Christians, let's remember we are following in the footsteps of our Saviour. Amen.